Hi, Lini.
Hey, Dong.
So we're back again, now this time with Lini Ryan, founder and editor of Mold Magazine. And she's actually been here since 2, setting up for her pickling workshop at 6 and just kind of running her shit from the office, which is really awesome.
Yeah, it's been fun. I've had a call with my client, and then Colin, who does all the programming events at MoFad, which is the Museum of Food and Drink, actually came by.
Really?
He came by, and we had like a little meeting about potential programs for spring 2019.
The space is working.
It's happening. I'm actually taking office hours at office hours.
It's incredible. I'm glad you committed to it. It's amazing.
You know, I really love Chinatown. I love what you guys are doing. I think it's so important to, you know, A, have accessible space, B, give young people an opportunity to kind of interact with a real range of different people, and also C, just have things happening in Chinatown. It's like, you know, I'm Chinese American, my parents are immigrants, and growing up, I only really knew that there were like, kind of like professionals in the sense of like being an engineer or like a lawyer or a doctor or like running a restaurant or I don't know, like working like, you know, kind of labor intensive jobs. And so it's kind of crazy that I work as a design journalist now, because I didn't even know that design was a profession until I came to New York at 18 and met designers who I thought were like the coolest people ever. And I was like, whoa, you're really cool and you work for yourself.
And you can make money doing this?
Yeah, and you go like snowboarding every like year in Chile, and like you DJ and you have a really cool office and you like have awesome books on your bookshelf. So I was just committed to like being friends and like hanging out with designers from that point forward.
Do you live in Chinatown?
No, I live in Crown Heights in Brooklyn.
But your office is here.
Yes, I work out of a studio space that my friends kind of run on Grand Street. And I always joke that I'm kind of like a one-person incubator program, because they have always supported me anytime I've kind of struck out on my own and like tried to kind of start my own business. Huh. They were my bosses about 10 years ago.
Oh, wow.
When they were running one of my most favorite print publications of all time, Theme Magazine. And they hired me in my like 20s to help manage and edit that magazine, and it forever changed my life.
Are they still running a magazine now?
No, they do not run a magazine right now. Now they actually, they have a branding design art direction firm called Emmett. It's Theme spelled backwards, and they do incredible work for a host of different clients, ranging from, you know, like Uniqlo and like Nike and Adidas to food brands.
Knowing that they used to run a magazine, did they encourage or like discourage you from running a magazine?
I think that what they did was, I mean, working for them basically gave me a very intimate understanding of like the realities of running an independent magazine and some of the challenges that it takes. So, you know, I was really lucky to be able to have like kind of a firsthand look at the like what it actually takes.
And so Mold is focused on food and design, or food design?
That's a really good question. So when I started Mold, it was a website, and it's thisismold.com. And it really started because I was fascinated with food design, which was like kind of an emerging field of design. Mm. And it kind of came out of industrial design practice primarily. And I was editing a website called Core 77. And I was traveling and seeing these really interesting projects around the world, primarily done by students, that was really looking at how design could be a vehicle and a framework for thinking about food, everything from how we produce food to how we eat food and how we engage with food. And at the time, there really wasn't anyone writing about it. So design publications were really focused still on like luxury goods, like furniture and lighting and architecture, as luxury. Mm-hmm. And, you know, food publications and food media, like, absolutely had no idea how to write about something like design. They would be like, oh, this is a weird idea. And so I really kind of took that opportunity to start my own project, and that's where Mold kind of grew out of.
Really dumb question. Can you explain what food design, like, even for me as a designer, the concept of food design as a term is even relatively new to me.
Yeah. I have to tell you that even amongst practitioners, it's quite controversial around where the boundaries of food design lie. Okay. And so my definition is how do we use food as a material and, to design products? And how do we design systems around, you know, how we eat and produce and engage with food? Mm-hmm. And so even though it started out as a food design website, or a website dedicated to showcasing food design projects, about a year and a half into working on stories on the website, I wrote about this project from an Australian poster designer, graphic designer. She's actually a communication designer, and named Gemma Warner. And it was her actual student, like kind of senior year thesis project. And she created a poster series that basically used images of produce to illustrate this white paper by the United Nations that predicted by the year 2050, if we continue to eat and drink the way that we do, we won't be able to feed the 9 billion people that will populate this planet. So it was kind of like raising a flag around the coming food crisis. Mm-hmm. And her project completely communicated kind of the ways that our food system is in crisis and ways that we could actually potentially address those things. And seeing that project really opened my eyes to the potential of food design. Mm-hmm. And that's when I kind of shifted gears and really started focusing on how design can actually offer a solution to the coming food crisis. So no matter if you kind of call yourself a food designer or not, or, you know, you prefer interaction designer or architect or fashion designer or communication designer or whatever field you're interested in, my goal with Mold is to really rally designers of all stripes around this idea that you can actually change and affect the food system. In fact, you should work to change the food system. And I believe that we should be changing it towards a more resilient, regenerative, transparent, accessible, ecosystem, like a food ecosystem.
What's interesting is I feel like across so many other design disciplines, architecture being the one I'm most familiar with, the terminology of design, or just that kind of like role of design, so often, like you said, becomes a luxury good or a kind of amenity or a decorative aesthetic treatment. And as you're describing this in food, I'm sure there's that as well. But there's what strikes me immediately is like so much of what you're talking about is inherently political, is inherently very rooted in just the kind of social systems that produce and deliver food everywhere.
100%.
And I do like that it's like, oh, don't forget, this is actually what design is. It's not really a decorative art.
Exactly.
You're looking to improve things.
And I mean, my message is really that designers are uniquely positioned to offer solutions to this very complex, very thorny, global, political, social problem. Hmm. Because, you know, there's plenty of technologists, engineers, biologists, agricultural people working in agriculture. There's people across, you know, all different disciplines who are interested in this question around how do we feed 9 billion people by the year 2050. But really, designers are trained for this specific challenge because they're trained to work across disciplines. They're trained to actually frame the right question, which I think most disciplines aren't ever taught to actually be like, well, what is the real problem that you're trying to solve? And more than that, they're trained to offer human-centered solutions, so things that people will live with intimately in their day-to-day lives, that are also in solutions that are scalable. Hmm. And we need all of those specific skill sets in order to address the coming food crisis.
It's also, I mean, amazing that, you know, food is, whether you are aware of the politics or the influence of the whole food system, everybody has a visceral relationship to food.
100%. There's not a single person that I have encountered that is like, oh, I don't really have any food memories, or I don't really have a relationship with food. I mean, or like, I don't have some favorite thing that I have eaten in the past. Everybody has an opinion about food. Everyone has food memory and food emotion. Mm-hmm. And I think that designers, again, are really uniquely positioned to tap into that. Because oftentimes there's these kind of future food solutions that are like a powder or like a pill, or you push a button. And nobody I know really wants to eat like that, because food is, you know, pleasure. Mm-hmm. Food is deliciousness. And food is one of, I mean, eating is one of the only things we do besides sex that engages all of our senses. So if we are, as humans, designed to experience food as a multisensorial thing, then we need to design for that. And I think designers really think about these types of things. I mean, the other thing that you kind of mentioned, which is, I think, very problematic, is that right now, I think mainstream food media and mainstream conversations around food are kind of one of two kinds. One is food as commodity and people as just consumers. So you have, like, you know, television shows, magazines, you know, coffee table tomes that are just all about consumption, mm-hmm. right? Like, you, the only kind of role that you have within the food system is to be a consumer, mm-hmm. and you can show off, you know, your status by, like, sharing the food that you have consumed. Right. And the other piece of it is, like, just gloom and doom, mm-hmm. and it's like fear mongering around the food system. Like, oh my God, calamari is actually, you know, pig intestines or whatever. Like, it's just like, you know, like all these stories that
it's also tasty, probably.
I mean, it's probably really delicious, but, like, you know, there's just a lot of fear mongering. I mean, some of it is real. So, for example, I grew up in Houston, Texas, and my father, I would say my father's, like, number one hobby of life is fishing. So I've grown up being completely privileged because I have always had access to fish that I know where it comes from. Usually my father has caught it himself, if not him, somebody he knows. We know where the water is that it comes from. And so moving to New York, I was always kind of suspicious of eating seafood in New York, unless it was like at some fancy restaurant. But what we've come to find out now, as there's become more transparency in the food system, is that, like, an insane percentage of seafood is fake. So it's like, this is sea bass, but it's maybe just tilapia, or this is, like, wild caught salmon and it's actually farmed salmon, or maybe it's not even salmon at all. So, and this also is happening in fine dining restaurants. Like, I think most recently there was a kind of spectacular fall from grace, which was from a company called, from, like, Dock to Table.
Oh, and, that's right. I'm reading on this.
Yeah, and they were basically, their whole business was model was about transparency from where their food comes from, where their seafood comes from. And they were selling to some of the, like, the best fine dining mm-hmm. restaurants in New York City. And it was all a sham. And so I just think that, like, that's why transparency as a value is something that I think is really critical. When we talk about the future of food, I think people really deserve to know where their food comes from. And not only that, I think that having more transparency in the food system will actually encourage people to engage more intimately with their food.
So getting back to, I think, because I feel like with mold, you have this ability to touch on so many direct but also indirect topics that food relates to. When you first started Mold, you said you started as a website. How long ago was it that you started it?
We launched a soft launch in fall of 2013, but we kind of officially launched during Design Week, May 2014.
Okay. And when did you add the print side to the website?
We launched our Kickstarter campaign for the print side in February or March of 2016.
Okay.
And the first issue came out, like, August 2016.
Got it.
And so we just released the third issue of the magazine this past September. And each issue, it's a biannual print magazine. I do it in collaboration with my co-editor, Johnny Drain, who's based in London. He's a food scientist. And the designers and art directors, Eric Hu and Matt Sang, the four of us have kind of been steering this print publication from the beginning. Mm. And basically, each issue is a different theme. And the first issue was about designing for the microbiome. So we talked about everything from fermentation to, you know, poop and kind of gut health to synthetic biology, which is the design of living organisms. The second issue was about how tableware and dining furniture can create new dining rituals. And the third issue, which just came out in September, is about how designers are transforming food waste into a resource to power, like, the cities and the lives of our future, whether it's about turning food waste into a raw material for the future or energy, or even just about using food waste to create, not food waste, but food surplus to create more dignity in dining.
And why did you decide to add the print side to it 3 issues ago?
I wanted, well, first and foremost, I'm a bit of a magazine junkie. I am kind of obsessively always collecting magazines everywhere I go. I love going to magazine stores. I've thought about who my tribe is, and it's probably people who love magazines. So I've always, just since I was very young, been very interested in print magazines. And the other thing was that as I was working on the website, I realized that people, even though we were publishing maybe 3 stories a week, people still didn't really understand what food design was. They didn't understand the purpose of the site. And I thought, well, if my audience is designers, I should create a design artifact. And that is probably one of the most effective ways of reaching the intended audience, is actually creating an artifact that designers would actually want to buy, collect, be intimate with. I mean, one of the things that we really try to advocate around is the idea that people should be more intimate with their food. So I'm like, let's create an artifact that people want to be intimate with, that they want to, like, touch and, like, you know, kind of sit with on their couch or in bed and kind of page lovingly through. And I think that that sort of consideration is very much felt when you pick up the magazine. It's not something that could live online, really. Mm-hmm. It's something that is really a physical artifact that needs to be experienced in a physical space.
And have you registered a change in either your audience or even how you approach the content you create for the magazine since you've moved to print?
I don't think the content has really changed that much. I think that in general, we're still interested in telling similar stories, but obviously creating content for print is a different process than creating content online. I think that obviously there's a kind of permanency to print that you don't really have online. We publish a lot of the stories that we do create for print online, but it's just a different experience. So I would say I'm very medium specific. So, you know, online is good for certain things, but print stories are also, like, you know, when we think about how to edit for print, we definitely think about how is this going to live on the page? Mm-hmm. Can we do footnotes? Should we do translations? Like, what is the artwork going to look like? How do we kind of create this artifact, something that people really want to take time with?
And you had, so before, or maybe during, you were at Core 77 before Mold.
That's right.
Was there an overlap of you starting it and still working with Core 77?
Yes and no. So being at Core 77 inspired me to start Mold, and then I left in order to kind of launch the site, the website.
Okay.
And then so I was consulting for 2 years and just basically freelancing.
At Core 77?
No.
Or just around?
So basically 2010 to 2012, I was just consulting. I was working at Core 77. Mm. In 2012, I left to start Mold. And then from 2012 to 2014, I was kind of working on Mold, but also consulting at the same time. I ended up getting a great job at the New York Times for 6 months. And then when that kind of wrapped up, I had already launched Mold. And then Core 77 was kind of in a transition period. They were transitioning into a new CMS, content management system. And they needed somebody who understood the old CMS, but could also help them transition into the new CMS. So then I went back for 2 years to kind of help them in this transition period. And then in 2016, I left again in order to launch the print magazine.
Got it. Okay. The first when you first left Core 77 to start the web version of Mold, you had said that Core 77 sort of inspired you to start Mold.
100%.
Is it like a specific thing that happened at Core 77? What happened at Core 77? What did you see there that I want
to
start my own
prior thing? To working at Core 77, I had like a loose idea what industrial design was, but I had never met an industrial designer, to my knowledge, at least. That's not true, actually. I just like wasn't familiar with industrial design as a practice. And so as an editor at Core 77, I really had a crash course, master's, you know, level training in the nuances of industrial design. This 2010 also was like a really critical moment for industrial design, because this is when like the iPhone came out. This is when, you know, VR was really starting to kind of have some legs in a kind of major way. And there was a lot of, the industrial design was kind of in an existential crisis. A lot of people were very concerned about the dematerialization of people's, you know, experiences. All of a sudden, user experience meant, you know, what was happening on a screen, not kind of haptic physical things. I think that people forget that was actually a real concern for a serious moment during that time. And so, you know, it was an incredible opportunity to have access to some of the most interesting people who are working and thinking about industrial design. And not only that, I had the ability to travel, attend conferences, go to design weeks around the world, and represent, I think, one of the most, one of the publications, online publications with the most, online design publications with the most integrity. Core 77 has been publishing online since 1996, and they have always been, it was actually an industrial, like the thesis project for, two industrial design students. And they were like, there's this thing called the web, and we should create a resource online for industrial designers. And so that's always been the heart of what they do. And it has really rallied an incredible community of people who actually work in that space. So it's like people who are really interested in like, what software are you using? How do you get, like what type of production is available? I mean, this also was a real kind of interesting moment because the DIY movement was really gaining steam. 3D printing was becoming accessible for, just consumer level interests. And so it was just kind of a critical moment in industrial design. And that really helped give me a framework for what the possibilities could be in the space of food design.
Was there any articles, any content out of Core 77 on food design at the time? Like, were you working on food-related things?
I had written a couple of pieces for Core 77 around things that I had seen at design weeks, but there wasn't really a focus on it. And it wasn't that they don't have... I mean, they could definitely have hosted a lot of that content, but I was just really interested in creating something. And it wasn't... To be honest with you, Mold was really started out as a nights and weekends hobby. Mm-hmm. It was something that I was just really passionate about. And I was like, I can just write about this all the time. And so I would go home at nights and write a story. I would like spend Saturdays or Sundays like working on Mold. And it ended up becoming one of the most expensive hobbies that I had ever embarked on. And I was like, okay, between hours, like labor hours spent on this, and also just money that I was like throwing in to like do little projects here and there, I was like, this is really becoming expensive. Right. And so this is a moment that I need to decide if this is just going to be forever my expensive hobby, or is this something that could be potentially be sustainable?
And at which point did it transfer from one to the other?
As far as like being my full-time job?
Yeah. Or being like, oh shit, this is actually not just an expensive hobby. This actually has legs to be...
I don't know. I'll tell you when that happens.
Okay.
I mean,
in progress.
Yeah, in progress. I think in 2016, I had like squirreled away a lot of money.
Okay.
Not a lot, but enough money to just kind of get me over the hump. Mm. And I was like, okay, I'm gonna just quit my awesome job, which I loved, and just see if this thing has real legs. Mm. And it's kind of been just a ride since then.
That's cool.
And so I've been very encouraged by the feedback that people have shared, by people like you guys who have invited me to participate in this amazing program. And also just in the general kind of interest in engaging designers with questions around the future of food. I think that all of those kind of signs from the universe have really given me the energy to continue. Also, I'm just extremely passionate about this space. Mm. I have been really blessed to be able to have incredible conversations with people who I feel like are world-changing, you know, just have world-changing ideas. And I just, this is the one of the few times in my life that I wake up every morning and I'm like
excited about it.
I'm like, yes, I get to go do this thing today. And like, you know, I have always, I mean, you can ask my mom who's probably listening, but I've like never been like a morning person. I've always been one of those people who's like, oh, I just want to like languish in bed for a couple more hours. But you know, now I like wake up at 7:30 and I usually take a call at 8 a.m. usually with somebody in Europe or in a different time zone. And it's something that I look forward to. And I feel really lucky that I get to do this every day.
So shout out to Lenny's mom.
Hi mom. Thanks for being mom.
So we had Felix from Pinup here. Mm-hmm. Yes. 2 days ago,
yeah.
2 days ago. And I'm sure this is not really a revelation for the magazine people, but he was like, look, don't go to magazines to make money. That's not at all the industry to go into, obviously. And obviously make sure you're passionate about what you're doing. And that obviously seems like why you wanted to start Mold in the first place. But I'd love to talk about that first, let's say, 6 months when you transitioned the first time from Chorus 77 into Mold Online, the mechanics of how to do that.
Well,
like, who did you find for writers? Were you writing everything yourself? How did you even figure out how to like publish on the web? Like all that stuff for anybody that wants to start a magazine or a website.
Sure. So Mold, first of all, is like the like sixth magazine or website that I've started. I mean, if you count like Zanga and like, you know, Blogspots and like, you know.
This is the second time Zanga's come up in these talks.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That's how Kevin from Hypebeast started.
Yeah, totally.
He has like personal journal that he hopes nobody finds.
I mean, I definitely had a Zanga page when I was like in high school. So I'm definitely of a generation. I'm also like, this is a little shout out. I was one of the first interns for Asian Avenue, which was like one of the world's first social media platforms.
Wow, that's crazy.
In 1998. And so I've basically have always been interested in publishing. Like I mentioned, I was like hoarding magazines from like 10 years old, like begging my mom to let me have subscriptions to magazines.
Sorry, small tangent. One of the first social media platforms was called Asian Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
It was basically kind of like MySpace.
Tell me more. it was 1998 is when I started working for them, and they must have launched in like 97 or something like that. Huh. Other people might be familiar with Black Planet. Or Mi Gente.
Is anybody out there familiar with Black Planet or Asian Avenue?
Yeah.
We got one.
So it was like basically, you know, just like Facebook today, you sign up, you get your own personal page, you can customize it. You had to know HTML, so you had to be able to like kind of navigate that world. And they also had a regular stream of content that they published. They had a stable of writers that would write about different things that were happening that you would publish on the main page. In fact, this is a really interesting thing. I have a friend, his name is Ray No, and I met him when I was interning at Asian Avenue in 1998, and he was writing a column for them called Love in a 10-Block Radius. He's one of the most brilliant writers I know. So then, fast forward, so Rain and I became friends, you know, we always would kind of touch base and say hello. And then fast forward to 2006 or 2007, I was working for Theme Magazine, which I mentioned earlier, and Rain was the kind of top editor at Theme Magazine. And so we were working together then, and he was kind of coaching me at that time because I really wanted to get into writing for magazines. So he gave me a lot of great feedback and advice about how to structure the feature writing that I was doing for them, how to do reporting, you know, places to get things transcribed. And then when Core 77 had an opening for a managing editor, he actually put my name forward because we had worked together at Theme. So Rain has been kind of this like silent hand in my career from the time I was like 18. But yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
All thanks to Asian Avenue.
All thanks to Asian Avenue, and also being from Texas, because my boss, so here we go. I went to this thing called Chinese Youth Camp when I was in high school, no, middle school and high school. And it's basically this thing in Texas where all the Chinese schools around Texas kind of band together for a one-week summer camp, and you just send your kids there. And we kind of joke that it's this thing where Chinese parents want their kids to meet other Chinese kids. Mm-hmm. And so you learn about like Chinese culture and like, I don't know, like it's basically you just go and like hang out and be kind of bad, mm-hmm. like without your parents and like, I don't know, just like meet boys, whatever. It was, I met some of my best friends of my life there. Mm-hmm. But one of my camp counselors at Chinese youth camp was the younger brother of my boss at Asian Avenue.
Okay.
And so I was like, oh my God, Betty is one of the top dogs at Asian Avenue. I emailed, or it must have been emailed, my camp counselor, and I was like, hey, can you introduce me to your sister? I want to work for Asian Avenue. And so, yeah, she just probably was just like, okay, you go to a good college here in New York, you're from Houston, you got the job, it's fine.
So I'm going to bug you more about Asian Avenue first.
Okay.
It was for Asians? I'm literally, this is like mind-blowing to me that...
Yeah.
It was
by Asians for Asians.
Where is it like locally specific?
I know
it's a social media thing, but like where it started out of Texas?
No, it started here in New York.
Okay.
It was, I think, four co-founders.
All Asian?
All Asian. East Asian. Like Chinese American, mm-hmm. Korean American. And it was like kind of during the Silicon Valley days. Silicon Alley days. So that's like late 1990s. Mm-hmm. And our office was in Soho. It was like, you know, before Soho was like
that's
this
so
kind
crazy.
Of mess that it is now. But yeah, they ended up launching Black Planet and Mi Gente. And some of the people that I met during that time are now like running Instagram or like running, like, you know, it's incredible. It was so ahead of its time, and people don't really talk about it because people don't want to talk about people of color being like the founders of these, you know, huge movements that we consider now.
Do you have any idea, and I don't know if you had a chance to talk to them then, but what the thinking was or why start a social media platform geared specifically to Asians?
I have no idea. I don't know the answer to it. My assumption is that they saw an opportunity, and you know, at the time, I mean, I'm thinking about from high school, I had a pretty diverse group of friends, but I would definitely say like Asian kids were probably the most plugged into like all that AOL chats, like chat rooms, Zanga. I was like straight up, sorry, Mom, if you're listening, but I used to like,
don't ruin her.
Just like, I would like wake up in the middle of the night and like dial into chat rooms to like talk to rando people in Houston about like raves and like weird parties. And I think my like handle was like China Girl, whatever, like Panda Raver or something. I don't know what it was, but it was like something in that vein, you know?
Amazing.
And, but it was like 1996. That's what you do. Cause like, you know, it was like definitely during that time, in order to access that type of community, you had to like search it out in that way. And it was pretty specific. So I don't know. I don't know what the answer is to that. I would love to hear from them. But
I'm so proud of Asians right now.
Yeah, man. Like I love kind of knowing where all these people are now, because it's something that is definitely part of my personal history. And I feel very thankful for being able to find community on places like Asian Avenue when I was like 18, or like when I was 15, weird dial-up chat, dial-in chat rooms.
Have you been part of, or yeah, I guess part of some version of an Asian community since Houston all the way up through college and all that stuff?
Yeah, so my parents immigrated to the United States, met here. They immigrated for graduate school in the 70s, and they met in South Carolina where they went to school. And so then they moved to Houston before I was one. And so I grew up, kind of to give you a little bit of to set the stage, I grew up in a Chinese, like first generation Chinese, mostly like kind of Taiwanese Chinese American community that was anchored by Chinese American churches and also Chinese schools. So those were kind of like the axes of social life for our community. There's somebody here who also grew up in, which is crazy, in the same community that I grew up in, the same suburb, Clear Lake, Clear Lake in Houston.
Did you just discover that?
We just discovered this, and so that was kind of the community social axes. But I was very like, kind of, I always had lots of different social circles growing up. But when I was in high school, I went to Chinese youth camp when I was 13. I discovered other Chinese American kids that were like me, like first generation, loved Aaliyah, loved Boyz II Men, was into Debrat, like, you know, just loved pop culture basically. And I was like, I am so stoked to be like, you know, people were DJing and like we went to dances. It was like a whole thing. And I was like, oh, I'm so stoked to be Chinese American. So I kind of pivoted in high school and I just really like sought out kind of Asian American social circles. And at that time, you know, this is like 1993, 94, kind of like gang culture was really prevalent amongst youth culture in the United States. It was really kind of the banner of rebellion. And so being first generation immigrants, being kind of growing up in a kind of very, I would say oppressively white and Texan kind of social setting, which it isn't the same now. Like Houston is so diverse and amazing, but, and I think for younger people now, it's probably doesn't feel the same. But at the time in the 90s, it definitely felt like if you weren't a cheerleader or like a football star or like a water polo star, like you didn't really have a place amongst like this kind of social ranking. And so I really started kind of like seeking out other groups of Asian Americans I wanted to hang out with. So in my high school, it was either like you were in orchestra or you're like gangbanging. And of course, like I was like, gangbangers have so much more fun. I want to go to the club. I want to go out. I want to go sing karaoke. I want to go hang out with like the cool kids with the like Rice Rockets. And, say, like,
did you have a rad car?
I didn't have a car because my parents were like, why would we give a 16-year-old a car? Like, that's ridiculous. But my friends had cars and all of them were like souped up and like, you know, it was like definitely a moment. I'm waiting for somebody to write a film, like a script or like make a movie about growing up in the 90s in Houston, Texas. So if anybody knows somebody who wants to get take this on, please let me know. I would love to contribute my archive of images and rave flyers and like weird, you know, Asian American ephemera.
Were there at your high school, were there a lot of Asians or just like a small pocket of either?
I don't know. You know, kids? It's kind of hard to like compare. Like I'm sure compared to like kids who grew up in LA or like Irvine or something, or even New York City, is probably not a lot, but you know, I graduate, like my high school had 3,000 kids. I graduated with like, we started with like 1,000 kids. We graduated probably with over 700. So I would say like there was enough Asian Americans in my high school to find a community.
You mean 700 Asians?
No, people in my class.
Oh, okay.
So we started with 3,000 people
got it.
In school, like 3,000 kids in all of our high school. Mm. That's for like ninth grade to 12th grade. And in my class, we started with 1,000 in ninth grade, and then we got kind of petered out to like 700 something by 12th grade.
Yesterday, we had Karen Wong from the New Museum.
She's
amazing.
Where did she grow up?
North Carolina.
Oh, interesting. I was born in North Carolina.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. She had around a 2,000 person high school, which is actually the same size as mine. But she was one of two Asian people at the high school. The other one was also a girl. They did not hang out.
Yeah.
And even my high school, which had a lot more Asians, but it wasn't quite enough for any kind of like Asian community to form.
Yeah.
You sort of just like nodded, like you knew the other Asians, but you never had like cliques of Asians.
No, our high school was pretty diverse. Mm-hmm. Like the community that I grew up with, like the suburb of Houston that I grew up in, you know, was really kind of like strongly middle class. Like we had kids that whose parents went into space as astronauts.
Amazing.
We also had kids whose parents, like, you know, were shrimping, like working on shrimping boats or owned their own shrimping boats. So it's kind of like a huge gamut of people, but pretty middle class. And I also think just because the industry in that area, you know, we had like the medical center, there's like a lot of chemical industries, like chemical factories there, and then NASA. It just, and also the University of Houston had like a little branch there. So it just in general was a pretty, I would say, balanced community.
Did you always know, or was there a point that you knew you wanted to start something on your own?
As a magazine, you mean?
Or anything. Like, was there a point when you were a kid, you're like, one day I can't work for someone else, or I need to be my own boss, whether it was a magazine or some other dream?
I don't know. I can't identify like a specific moment, but I do remember taking art classes in the summer and then telling my mom I wanted to be an artist when I grew up. And she was like, yeah. And like, she was like, you're never taking an art class again. And so I think that, I mean, my parents in general are incredibly supportive humans and also very encouraging of me and my brother to just kind of do the things that are fulfilling for us. Mm-hmm. And so I think that my father has always had a little bit of an entrepreneurial bent to him. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, you know, we're really privileged that we kind of grew up in an environment where we were really encouraged to think about the opportunities that were ahead of us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, also have the support of our families to really carve our own paths, whatever it was going to, right, whatever it is. Yeah. So that's like a certain kind of privilege that I think not everybody has. I know that not everyone has. And so I feel very thankful for that.
Did you have, so after Houston, where'd you go?
I went to Columbia.
Okay.
And basically I had brokered a deal with my parents that if I got into like a certain kind of fancy school, that they would let me leave Texas. Because otherwise it was like, oh, you can just go to Rice or University of Texas or whatever.
That's, you already had a desire then at that point to leave Texas.
I was like doing anything to like get out of Texas. Huh. I was like, I gotta leave. Like, huh, I can't be here. So
do you remember why that was? Or where that kind of inclination came from?
Because I was like a, you know, hormonal teenager, and it's like nobody understands me here, and I don't know. It was, you know, just, I think I just was like ready. I was really looking for my tribe, you know? And so I came here to New York, and I was planning to study East Asian studies, but, I took a couple East Asian studies class that were like classical Chinese literature or whatever, you know, classical Chinese art. And I was like so bored, and, I kind of got recruited by these like really cool people of color who were like, yeah, we were part of this ethnic studies struggle in 1996 at Columbia. We were part of a hunger strike, and we took over the school building, and we basically forced the administration to have a conversation with us about having agency over our education. And I was like, oh, you guys are like beautiful brown people who are rebellious. Like, I'm super down for being part of this cause. And so I ended up becoming an Asian American Studies major. And I think I was like the second year to graduate with an Asian American Studies major at Columbia.
When you say you got recruited, did they tap you on the shoulder?
Just no, like, it was kind of, I mean, a little bit. I think, I don't really know how they identified us, and I actually had a conversation with some of my friends from college about this recently. I think it was just like, I don't know. I have no idea why they thought I would be interested in this, but they were right. Like, it was a pretty life-changing decision for me, and it's been really interesting actually in recent political conversation to see a lot of the language that I learned when I was in college studying, you know, the social constructs of race and gender, and the history of Asian people in the United States, to see that in the mainstream and see that in mainstream media and language. And it's really an incredible shift to actually start hearing just normal 18-year-olds being like, yeah, duh, race is a social construct. And like them knowing what that means, I had never had access to ideas like that at that age. And so it's pretty, I'm just like so blown away by how wise and just tapped in a lot of young people are these days.
You said you switched your major to Asian American Studies?
Yes.
And you graduated with Asian American Studies?
Yes.
Major.
My parents are like, why did we send you to Columbia to get an Asian American studies major?
You know all about it.
They're like, don't you just know what that means?
Actually, related to that,
are we going to talk about Crazy Rich Asians now?
We'll get there. Probably a good transition. Well, I was going to ask, basically, it's like, of your, because it seemed like you grew up in a very strong Asian community. You had a very strong kind of, let's say, clique of friends. You met a lot of amazing people of color, and you actually studied Asian American studies. And a lot of, obviously, a lot of your work, certainly up until that point, was very much tied into your own identity.
Mm.
Is that, do you still feel like that's the case, whether with Mold or the things you were doing at Core 77, like, is always centralized in some way with you being an Asian American, either directly or indirectly?
That's a really good question. I think that being a woman of color in the United States that is from an immigrant family really means that my lens into the world and the way that I kind of understand power and access is really shaped by those things. So I wouldn't say that my work at Mold is directly connected to being Asian American, but I would say that the lens that I'm taking on the potential of design to actually change the food system definitely comes from a place of optimism, mm-hmm. and a place that recognizes that people who are disenfranchised, people who don't think that they have agency in large complex systems, in fact, actually do. And the way to harness that is by creating collective consciousness in education and motivating people to like take action.
Do you feel any like a daily consciousness of representing Asian Americans?
No, because whether I like it or not, I am an Asian American woman and I can't really control how other people read that, but I don't feel pressure around it, mm-hmm. but I know it as a fact.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's talk about Crazy Rich Asians.
I knew that. Someone warned me that this was going to be part of our conversation.
Weirdly, it's only come up like twice.
Well,
I thought it would come up a lot more.
I don't know. I'd like to hear your perspective on it because I was surprised that this would come up, but I then prepared myself mentally to talk about it.
So you saw it?
Yes, I saw it on opening day.
Oh, wow.
With my mom and my husband. I happened to be in Houston on opening day, so we went to a matinee. Like, I think it was like, we definitely got, my mom had like a coupon or something. We definitely got like some sort of discount matinee ticket, but we went on opening day.
What did your mom think?
Oh, she loved it. We laughed, cried. I also went with my mother and my grandmother. I don't think it was opening day, but maybe opening week to Joy Luck Club.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I feel like we're into it. Like, we are committed to supporting the franchise.
you've thought about this. So what was your thought of the movie?
I loved it. I would watch it again. I thought it was for the people.
Did it actually feel like a milestone or any kind of transformative moment when you saw it?
I don't know about transformative. I'll be honest with you. I went because I wanted to just support an all Asian cast is it a Disney movie? Major studio movie with an all Asian cast. And so, but you know, I didn't have like great expectations for it, but I came out of it and I was like, this was great. I would totally watch this mm-hmm. again. And I don't feel that way about every movie that I watch. Mm-hmm. And so, I thought it was like lighthearted. I thought it was fun. I cried. I laughed. There was like things for people who are Chinese American who would get that. And then there's things for everybody else. So it was quite an inclusive film. So I thought it was successful on a lot of different levels. How did you feel about it, Dong?
I liked it way more than I thought I would like
yeah.
it. I actually really, when I saw the trailer,
yeah,
I was like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah. Okay.
This is terrible.
Oh, you just thought it was like,
well, it looked like a shitty movie.
Okay.
Like the trailer was really shitty.
Yeah.
And it was also just like, you are going to set us back like 50 years, you asshole. Like it just looked terrible.
Yeah.
And like everything about it was like, I don't identify. This is not Asians as I know them.
Yeah.
I have no relationship to this movie whatsoever. But that's where the surprise came in is like, I think I was telling Paul yesterday, just purely that they were Asian affected me way more than I thought it would.
Oh, I love that.
Like just seeing a 20-foot Asian person on screen.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, shit. Like, I had no, because I have no direct relationship to any of their life stories.
Sure.
Honestly,
yeah, neither do. I mean, no one does, yeah. really. Like, that's the magic of it. Like, nobody has had that experience.
It was just like the straight up superficiality that they were Asian.
Yeah.
And I was like, sweet.
You know, to be honest with you, I really sought out Asian figureheads in my youth. Mm. So, like, my playlist today started with Jackie Chung and it ended with Faye Wong. And when I was in high school, when I was kind of going through this identity crisis, I really sought out Asian celebrities. Mm. And the only place at that time that you could really look was Asia. Mm-hmm. So I watched, like, you know, of course, Wong Kar-wai, but, like, you know, I was watching, like, Raise the Red Lantern. I was, like, watching, like, all these weird... I was, like, going to Blockbuster and renting all the different Asian movies that they had there. And, like, I was obsessed with Zhang Yimou. Mm. And, like, you know, I really sought it out. And also, like, with, like I mentioned, Joy Luck Club, you know, Russell Wong was, like, a star on network television during that time. And people forget that he was in, like, Vanishing Sun or something. I don't remember the name of this, the TV show, but he was on network television. And so, and Ming-Na Wen was, like, huge. She was on, like, one of those, like, emergency room shows. And so, all of a sudden, like, Asian people were on television. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think I felt the shock of seeing Asians on the big screen. I just was entertained and I thought it was just a great movie for being a great movie. You know, to be honest, I had that feeling when I watched Wonder Woman.
Really?
Yeah. Nice. I was like in just like so emotional watching Wonder Woman. There's a scene in the opening where they're like on that like idyllic island and all the warriors were like on their horses and they are like archers and slashing throats, and I was like, holy shit, like I have never seen women portrayed with such strength as real warriors on a big screen, and it's not like campy, it like felt so real, and I was like so unexpectedly moved by that experience.
It's interesting because I think you may be the first guest, I'm trying to think, that certainly I think first Asian guest that grew up very aware and actually very plugged into, let's say, Asian culture, and myself included, the general pattern has been that, for example, now I'm reconnecting with my Chinese Americanness because.
Where did you grow up, Dong?
San Diego.
Okay. And yeah, I feel like it's a difference.
It's completely, I think, related to
geography.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I definitely. If you ask other. I mean, we can ask another Chinese American person who grew up in Houston right now. But like, I just think growing up in Houston, being Chinese American or Asian American was like a very specific experience. And I feel like there was a definite sense of otherness that comes from being, you know, in a pretty robust immigrant community, but also so clearly othered by mainstream culture that it really created this very strange, because like my other friends who grew up in Houston at the same time as I did also have very similar kind of experiences and are kind of strangely pro-Chinese, even though they may not feel that way, or pro-Asian, even though they may not feel that way. But we have a very common language around, you know, funny like Chinese or, Chinese pop culture moments. We also like, you know, there was a kind of phenomenon in the aughts where some of the kids that we grew up with in Houston who are Taiwanese or Chinese American went back to Taiwan to become like superstars. No, seriously, like rap stars, like basically like VJs on television because they were like, you know, cool and Asian American, but could also speak Chinese. You know, so there's like people who I grew up with in Houston who are now like major pop stars in Taiwan. VJs, like one of the first rap groups or whatever, like Chinese rap groups. It's like this weird kind of internationalism that I think for some reason came out of Houston.
Did you feel at all that with such a like a prevalent Asian community growing up and kind of prevalent Asian culture growing up, did you feel that it was that you were part of American culture or that you were part of a separate culture within America? Or something else.
That's interesting. We're definitely American. Like, I mean, I mentioned that it took going to a Chinese youth camp with all Chinese kids, but seeing that we loved, like, Debrat and, like, we were interested in the Monica and Brandy, you know, shakeout and like, you know, like, you know, could talk about all these things, like love Snoop Dogg, knew all the words to Salt and Pepper. Like we just, it took going to this kind of weird third space where we are all Chinese American kids, but we love the same cultural touchstones mm-hmm. to kind of, that became my community. Cause I was like, oh yeah, like we can talk about all these things mm-hmm. together at the same time. We can talk about Fei Wong and like weird, like stuff, like eat all the Asian snacks and have no like food shame.
Right.
And then also like talk about, you know, whatever MTV thing is going down.
Cause that's definitely something that I'll use San Diego as my touch point for that, that I think you sort of had to choose growing up whether you were going to be Asian-y or whether you're going to be American-y. Mm. And in terms of not only the cultures you were into and the kinds of music you listened to, and it wasn't like someone was asking you to make that decision. It was just sort of the pressure of like, am I going to become the Asian kid or am I going to try to become the American kid?
Mm.
And there wasn't really that much of the community that was very comfortably being both.
Yeah.
Or the kind of whatever, like an Asian American as a singular definition.
Yeah.
That didn't really exist that clearly for maybe, I mean, I think the first time I saw it was maybe in college.
Yeah.
Where there were certain pockets that were doing that. But
I think that, like, I have to give credit to my parents' generation because, like, Houston is like the fourth largest city in the United States. It's huge. There were kind of three major Chinese churches in Houston, and that was kind of one hub of activity, right? And so obviously your parents are dragging you to church every Sunday. You have to like hang out with the church kids, whether you like them or not. And you're like, oh, you're kind of churchy. You're kind of churchy for me. But like, you know, then you see these kids all the time. And so all of a sudden you have a relationship with Chinese kids who live across town. And maybe you think someone's cute and then you get invited to prom or whatever. And like, it just happens. And then the second hub of that being the Chinese schools, and also this whole Chinese youth camp thing, mm-hmm. Became like another hub of activity that really connected people as a way of like just finding other community. And I don't know if it was like purpose driven, mm-hmm. but it definitely became a way to meet kids that like from across Texas who had exactly similar background as I did, you know? There's also Love Boat, which is a whole other conversation. Do you know about Love Boat?
I don't know about Love Boat. Oh, wait. Yes.
Dean is over here. And Gene, did you go to Love Boat? Okay. So Love Boat is basically, for those people who are uninitiated with Love Boat, if you're Taiwanese American, there's an opportunity for you during the summer to go to Taiwan, and it's basically the same format as Chinese youth camp. You go to Taiwan and you do a cultural tour of Taiwan, and they call it Love Boat because every year somebody gets pregnant and it's like a whole thing, and people meet their husbands, they meet their ex-wives. It's like a whole cultural thing. My mom was like, no, you're not going on that. But I was like, I just want to go meet other Chinese kids from around the United States.
Is it actually on a boat?
No, it's not on a boat, but you know, Taiwan's an island. So it's like, I don't know. I don't think it's on a boat, right? I don't think it's actually like on a boat. I don't
Love Island.
Yeah, I don't know why it's called Love Boat.
I had not heard that term in relationship to
Asians
for a long time.
Yeah,
I was like, oh shit! I totally just remember hearing about people that would go to that
Love Boat, right? Yeah. I think that also was something that was marketed through the Chinese school network in the United States.
So then, maybe sort of last round of questions, because actually, since your experience is actually really different in a lot of ways than a lot of the guests, and I'm really fascinated kind of what, and we're in Chinatown and you work in Chinatown,
yeah,
what your take on Chinatown is, like the one we're sitting in now, in terms of not only how it is now, but kind of where you see it going,
yeah,
where you'd like to see it going, let's say.
Interesting. Like, so I moved to New York in 1998, and Chinatown has always been a refuge for me. In fact, the place where I bought the mustard greens mm-hmm. that we're going to be pickling now is the same grocery store I've been going to for 20 years.
Is it Hong Kong supermarket?
Yeah, on Hester and Elizabeth. I've gone through every iteration of that supermarket. It's the place that I bought my first cell phone when I first moved to New York. And the reason why is because I went to this church across the street called OCM, Overseas Chinese Mission, and I was like, oh, I can go to church and then go grocery shopping. Like, done. And so like, I've basically been coming to Chinatown from the day one that I came to New York. Mm. I think I actually came with my mom to buy a rice cooker, because the first things we did is we bought a laundry bag, a rice cooker, and like a winter coat. Mm. That was like the things on her checklist of things to buy. So I've been coming to this Chinatown for 20 years. I mean, the other thing is, you know, when I kind of first learned about, when I first started to hang out with all these designers, we used to go to this place called Good World Bar, mm-hmm. which is
down
now...
It was down the street.
Literally down the street. And it was, like, where all the cool kids mm-hmm. hang out. Like, and so I was like, oh, also Chinatown is this place where cool kids hang out. And then, like, in, you know, when I was 19 or 20, I started going to this club down here called Fun and, like, basically spent the last 2 years of college, like, being a weirdo and, like, hanging out at Fun, like, every weekend. And so, you know, my grandfather was a journalist in Chinatown in the 70s, and he used to live right here off the East Broadway stop, and it was a different place then. But I have always loved Chinatown because it's for Chinese people. It's mm-hmm. not trying to be, like, a tourist attraction.
Right.
It's parts of it have become that. But I hope is that Chinatown continues to be for Chinese people. I think we need it. Like, I love that New York has three Chinatowns. It, like, makes me so happy.
I mean, especially the one in here in Manhattan, in terms of its ability, probably more than any other neighborhood really in Manhattan, to resist
gentrification.
I mean,
yeah, it's organized resistance,
right.
You know? And I think that more things like this need to happen where there is an open door policy, to have kind of this new group of people who have moved here to actually engage with Chinese people, not as just this weird huddling mass, but as like humans mm-hmm. who have created this space and have been, you know, keeping businesses alive for the last, like, you know, 50 years.
Mm-hmm. Do you see a need for it to evolve at all? Chinatown, I mean?
I mean, I think that's for the residents of Chinatown to decide, right? I think that there's a lot of basic needs that need to be met in Chinatown. Like, you know, housing is still an issue here in Chinatown. Healthcare, education, access to, you know, services. Like, East Broadway was, like, disgusting mm-hmm. and, like, a mess before white people moved here. So it's like, you know, the people of Chinatown deserve to have all the same privileges that everybody else in the city do. And so I think that those things should really change. So with gentrification, with all this new money coming in, my hope is that the people and residents of Chinatown get to see that type of, you know, investment in their day-to-day lives as well.
Mm. And then I guess lastly, do you see, because in my kind of picture of Chinatown is that it's very much a sort of bubble within the city
mm-hmm.
and it's retained this separation in a way from everything else that goes on in the city.
Mm-hmm.
But I was curious whether that was coming from my perspective because there was always a separation of Chinese-ness and American-ness growing up, whereas it seems like yours was much more seamless between those two cultures.
I think it depends on like what you mean by separation. Like the majority of people who work in Chinatown don't live here.
Mm.
They're not immigrating, but they're like coming in on the train, commuting yeah. from like Brooklyn, Queens, you know, wherever uptown. Like, I don't, you know, it's like they're coming from all over the place. So the separation might be language, but Chinatown is a living, breathing, amorphous organism that is constantly shifting. And so I think that it's just important to recognize that for people who feel like it is this kind of weird bubble, it's not. It's like it's actually being fed every single day by people from all over the city, but a lot of them are Chinese people. Mm. So I don't know if that answers your question.
But it does. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You want to pickle stuff?
Let's do it.
Cool. Thank you so much for...
Thanks for having
being
me.
...being here for the hour.
Yeah.
Or even longer, I guess, actually.
Yeah.
And if anybody that is on their way here, we'll probably start pickling in...
Now.
Mm-hmm. So hurry up.
Let's do it.
Cool.
Okay.
Thanks, Lindy.
Thank you, Dong. Bye.